that would kind of the meeting. That is the election of the acting chairperson. And seeing that the chairperson, Honorable Farisan, will not be part of the meeting. Without any waste of time, can I entertain nomination for the position of acting chairperson for this meeting? Honorable Martua.
Yes. My name is Rosalia Mruto. I'm a member of this committee, and I wish to propose the name of Peter Maluleka to be an acting chair.
Thank you. Any seconder for the name? Honorable Shivas.
I'm seconding the name of Peter Maluleka.
Any opposition or abstention? In the absence of any opposition and abstentions, I call on Honorable Maluleka to take the seat.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning, members and officials from the from our department and staff. I think PMG is also here, and PMG, you're all welcome to this meeting. We have lost a bit of time already. I'm going to. All of us to try and stick to the issues that we will be discussing. There's a debate this afternoon. On National Heritage Day or Heritage Month, and there are members in this committee who will be participating in that debate, so I would also like us not to keep them long so that they go and brush up their speeches. Do we have any apologies? Any other apologies? Okay. So only note those two apologies. We're going to get straight into item three, which is a briefing on the arts and culture on UNESCO's cultural and cultural diversity. I don't know who's going to lead us here, DG. May I also find, because I know some of you also have to go to the select committee. How long will the presentation take?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. We have decided to split ourselves.
There's
some colleagues at the select committee, but we are here. The manner in which we were proposing to deal with the briefing is that my colleague on the left, Ms. Louise Graham, she's the Chief Director for International Relations, that she will take us through that, and then we will handle any questions and any issues that might require some clarification. if that is acceptable.
Yeah, no, I think that's fine. Let me just try to do things right. I think on our agenda, we all have a copy of the agenda. It says just a briefing there. I think it will be the briefing and discussion on the briefing. Do members have anything that they would like to add to this agenda? Can we have a mover for the adoption of the agenda? Ma, Umalo Mo?
I move for adoption.
Okay. Can you second that? Manyalunga, second. I think let's introduce one another before we start with the presentation.
My concern is that we don't have any opposition today, which means that it will be faster.
It's a pity they are not here, but I hope they may join us while the meeting is on. Can we introduce ourselves? I'll start on my right. We'll start with members and then officials from the department.
Thank you, Chair. I'm a member of this committee.
Thank you.
Mundum Mado, member of Urban Culture Committee. I'm from Gauteng. Thank you.
The name is Tori Mruta. I'm a member of this committee. I'm a component of the African National Congress.
Thank you. Tobowane from the Great Limpopo, a member of the very same committee, which is Urban Culture. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair, members. Feliswa Paduza, Department of Arts and Culture.
Good morning, Chairperson, Honourable Members, Louise Kim, Chief Director, International Relations for the Department of Arts and Culture.
Temba Wagashi, Department of Arts and Culture.
Linda Landaba from PMG.
Member of this committee, and I represent the ANC on this. Yeah, we can then, if you're ready, start with the presentation. Yeah.
Chairperson, honourable members, can you hear me well? Thank you. My apologies, Chair. The department was asked to do a briefing this morning on UNESCO and cultural diversity. We've decided to structure our presentation in the following manner, but we will also be guided by the committee. We propose to do a brief introduction and a background, spend very little time on that, but just to set the scene for UNESCO, who and what it is, and how we engage with it. then UNESCO's strategic framework within which the cultural diversity is a component. We want to mention briefly the South African National Commission, which is really the focal point in South Africa for all UNESCO matters. Then come to arts and culture and UNESCO in the areas that we particularly focus on. And then move on to the core of our discussion today, which is UNESCO and the cultural diversity. We then want to focus specifically on the convention, which has become the standard-setting instrument for cultural diversity, talk a little bit about the process of implementation and where we are at the moment with regard to the implementation, and then our conclusion on the way forward. If you are in agreement, Chair, that is how we will proceed. Thank you, Chair. By way of introduction and background, and as I mentioned, this will be very consolidated, very short and brief. It's just really to set the scene. To remind ourselves that UNESCO is one of the 15 specialized agencies of the United Nations, and it is specifically tasked with a mandate for education, the sciences, both natural sciences and social sciences, culture, and then communications and information. It therefore has a very broad mandate in the United Nations and a very diverse mandate. UNESCO is also considered not to be a downstream implementing agency like, for example, UNICEF that deals with children. They don't build schools, they don't set up clinics. It is arguably considered to be the think tank of the United Nations. They therefore have a relatively small budget in the region of $600 million US a year, and it's also not a funding agency. Chair, do I understand correctly just in terms of UNESCO, the acronym?
The acronym.
Ah, okay. My apologies, Chair. UNESCO stands for the United Nations Educational, Scientific, Cultural Organization. Thank you. As I mentioned, they have the mandate for the four main areas, with the sciences being divided into two, both social sciences and natural sciences. And just to give an example there, in terms of the natural sciences, UNESCO is, for example, the overall coordinating body in the UN for the question of fresh water and also oceans. So you have a UN body that is the coordinating agency for 23 other bodies all across the globe that has the mandate to deal with the global issues around fresh water. Just to give an example, that is what they do in science. In education, UNESCO is tasked with the Education for All mandate of the UN, and I'm sure that honourable members are familiar with that concept. In culture, the main focus is on international standard setting and norm setting. In other words, the negotiation of international treaties on the protection of arts and culture. At the moment, UNESCO's membership is 193, and you will see that this is almost universal membership in the UN, and also 7 associate members. Now, the associate members are, for example, the EU, the European Union, have brought together their members in a number of specific areas where they do not anymore negotiate internationally as individual member states, but rather as a collective. So the EU is one of the associate members of UNESCO. UNESCO is based in Paris, as you are aware. The UN also has offices in Nairobi, in Rome, Paris, and Japan, and London, and a number of other venues. And UNESCO also has, so their headquarters is in Paris, and they have over 50 field offices. In some countries, they have individual country offices. For example, in countries that are in post-conflict, they have a country office in Mozambique. They also have regional offices. They, for example, have an office in Windhoek that covers a number of the southern African countries, including South Africa, Botswana, Lesotho, Swaziland, and Namibia. They're not strictly organized according to the divisions that we have ourselves. So in other words, they're not static orientated. They have their own subdivisions. Then, as I mentioned, they have, within the four or five broad areas of mandate that UNESCO have, there are a number of priority projects, and we only lifted out a few here to give an illustration of what that is. For example, in the field of education, they would deal with literacy, technical and teachers training programs. They would deal with international science programs, and I've mentioned the water program. They deal with the promotion of the independent media and the freedom of the press. And you would know that UNESCO annually gives out an international press award, and they are very involved in the safety of media and press in areas of conflict. They deal with cultural history projects, and we will come to some of those a bit later. They have the focus, they have an extensive program on cultural diversity, which is our main focus. And then, of course, a very large program on heritage, both world heritage, which is quite familiar, but also aspects of intangible cultural heritage, underwater cultural heritage, and so on. And they also focus on bridging attempts to bring together the digital divide. Now, UNESCO manages its strategic objectives within a five-year framework, which is currently running from 2008 to 2013, and it is organized and arranged around the core mandates that I mentioned. The main focus for education is education for all and lifelong learning. This is the core program that they manage. Mobilizing scientific knowledge and sustainable development. This is the main focus in the sciences area. The social sciences area deals with social and ethical challenges. And there is a specific committee in UNESCO that deals with bioethics, the ethics of biology and science. And honorable members may recall that Judge Albie Sachs served on that committee for South Africa for a number of years. Then in the field of culture, the focus is on cultural diversity, intercultural dialogue, which is very closely linked to cultural diversity, and then a culture of peace. And we will talk a little bit more about that later, because these are all really very integrated. The focus in the communication sector is on knowledge societies through information and communication. Then there are two what can be called cross-cutting global priority themes, and the one is specifically on Africa, and the other one is on gender equality. And the Africa programs are collected or collated within a structured relationship that UNESCO has with the African Union and through the African Union with the NEPAD program. The strategic framework is also aligned very briefly to the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, and there are some of the eight goals that specifically speaks to the mandate of UNESCO. The first one relates to halving the number of people living in extreme poverty in developing countries by 2011. This is a UN goal and a UN mandate that UNESCO fits into. The second one and the third one relates to education, achieving universal primary education and eliminating the gender disparity in education. The last two talk specifically to environmental issues, developing national strategies for sustainable development and also reversing or halting the trend in the loss of environmental resources by 2015. And the last one is particularly focused on UNESCO's heritage program because the heritage program, the World Heritage specifically, focuses on both cultural and on natural heritage. In other words, our national parks, but also our cultural heritage sites. The South African National Commission for UNESCO, as I mentioned, that this is the focal point in South Africa where both the inputs from UNESCO, but also the department's coordination comes together. They were established in 1998, and the purpose, as it says, is to integrate and coordinate the UNESCO activities coming into South Africa, but also the reverse, the national positions going to UNESCO. In other words, from a diversity of departments, also gets channeled through the SA National Commission. The NATCOM is under the leadership of the Minister of Basic Education, and the Department of Basic Education is the department for South Africa's relations with UNESCO. And the reason for that is that education is the main focus, one of the main focuses of the organization. At the moment there are six line function departments that are serviced by the National Commission on a permanent basis, and then other departments, as is relevant, then gets drawn in, and it's obviously the ones that relate to the main focus. So you will have science and technology there, arts and culture, basic education, higher education, and then other departments as it becomes relevant. Environmental affairs and water affairs, forestries, and so on. As it relates to the program. There is a vision of the NATCOM. The focus is on a knowledge-based society, creating a knowledge-based society through the pursuance of excellence in the fields that UNESCO is responsible for. There is a number of details on the mission of the South African National Commission, how they are supporting transformation of the society, implementing the UNESCO programs in the various fields, the cooperation on national UNESCO issues between the national departments, adherence to the ethical standards, and this we have referred to before, and the application of the international treaties, this we had also referred to specifically in culture, but not only in culture. There are also international treaties that South Africa is a member state of in the other fields of competence of UNESCO. And it acts as a channel, as I mentioned, not only with UNESCO, but also with the regional bodies. There's also a regional body in Nairobi. There's a regional body in Zimbabwe, in Harare. And then the BINTUK office, which is for Southern Africa, including South Africa, and also the Mozambique office. And then the effective participation in the affairs of UNESCO, which is the ongoing day-to-day operational issues. The Department of Arts and Culture and our involvement with UNESCO is primarily focused in a number of key areas. The very first one is heritage, which I've already mentioned, and this focuses on world heritage, intangible heritage, underwater cultural heritage, and a number of other areas, also including cultural diversity. And then one that I want to lift up particularly is the memory of the world, which we have a separate slide on, so we'll come back to that one. Honorable members will recall that South Africa was readmitted to UNESCO in 1994. In 1997, we ratified some of the international treaties that specifically relate to culture, and in particular the World Heritage Convention treaty. South Africa was then also very actively, post-94, became involved in a number of arenas that relate to UNESCO. We were elected to be a World Heritage Committee member, and we served for 5 years. Well, I think it was almost 6 years, from 2000 to 2005. And then we were recently, at the end of 2009, we were re-elected onto that committee. This one relates particularly to culture, but of course South Africa also served on a number of other intergovernmental committees in UNESCO. Former Minister Zola Skweyiya served on MOST, which is a program on countries in social transformation. It's a social sciences program. He served as the chairperson for that committee for a number of years. I mentioned Judge Albie Sachs, who had served on the bioethics committee, and there are a whole range of others in the fields of education, sciences, South Africa is also a very active member in the Intergovernmental Oceanographic Commission, which is the global body looking at the protection of the oceans. So in all the various fields, South Africa has served on the UNESCO committee. In terms of culture, and as specifically related to World Heritage, South Africa then also, through the Department of Arts and Culture, hosted the 29th session of the World Heritage Committee in 2005 in Durban. Very successful, one of the most successful committee meetings ever. And that also resulted in the establishment of an African World Heritage Fund in 2006. And South Africa currently still serves, the Director General serves as the chairperson of the board of the African World Heritage Fund. One of, arguably one of the most successful initiatives coming out of Africa in the field of the protection and promotion of culture and specifically world heritage. I should also just mention here that the African World Heritage Fund was earlier in the year was recognized by UNESCO as a Category 2, which is a close, which is really a stamp of approval and a close association with UNESCO. It is functionally autonomous, but it bears the UNESCO name and the UNESCO logo and the UNESCO support. And this was one of the first in the world. There were a number of others, but it was the first one out of Africa. It was also the first one in the particular model and the particular type that was established and has since been duplicated in a number of other areas, a number of other areas around the world, including in Latin America, in Eastern Europe, and in Asia. Briefly on the memory of the world, I just want to mention, there is some detail here, but I just want to lift out two things. South Africa became involved in 2003. Memory of the World is a UNESCO or a global or a UN initiative that is specifically focused on the preservation of the world's documentary heritage. So it does not deal with anything else. It deals with documentation. It's therefore very closely linked to library services, art, and national archives. There is a number of initiatives that South Africa had undertaken. We are chairing the African Regional Chapter. We also hosted the AIDS Advisory Committee. But maybe what is important for us is specifically that two of the South African collections have been accepted for protection under the Memory of the World, the UN program. And the one relates to the Rivonia Trial Collection, which is based at the National Archives of South Africa, and the second one relates to the Living Apartheid Collection, which is housed at the Doxa Productions in Cape Town. There were two further, that the second last bullet talks to three, but it's actually two further collections that have been proposed by South Africa to be included in the Memory of the World program. And the one relates to the Cordesa multi-party negotiations of Kempton Park, and then the second one, the Art Ensemble Collection at Freedom Park. The reason why this is important for us is because it provides rights but also obligations for the state party in terms of the protection of these collections. It means that we can tap into global resources and really means that these collections become part of global heritage rather than just South African heritage. With regard to cultural diversity, to come to that part specifically, there are a number of issues there that is relevant, but the conceptual one is one of the most important, the way that it has developed, the way that it is being seen today. So I have a number of slides that talks about the different aspects of the conceptual development of cultural diversity. The first one was that UNESCO sees cultural diversity as inexplicably and linked to development. And not only in the field of economic growth, but also at a level, and this is where UNESCO as the think tank for the UN plays a very strong role, that cultural diversity is also closely related to the intellectual, emotional, moral, and spiritual life of individuals. And the concept of cultural diversity has been encapsulated in each one of the seven United Nations, or specifically UNESCO, cultural conventions. I've mentioned some of them relating to world heritage, but there are of course also older cultural conventions, international treaties. The 1954 Hague Convention on the Illicit Trafficking in Cultural Goods. There's the 1970 Convention that relates to the restitution of cultural property. 2001 Underwater Cultural Heritage Convention, Intangible Convention 2003, and then culminating in 2005 in the International Convention that deals specifically with cultural diversity. The other aspect that is important in terms of cultural diversity is that it is considered to be the link between dialogue, if I can say dialogue, or fostering dialogue between civilizations, and also fostering respect and mutual understanding. And why this has become particularly pertinent is because it is linked to a number of global issues which do not by themselves speak to culture. And just to give two examples, you will recall that in the term of former President George Bush of the U.S., he talked about an axis of evil. And even before that, Samuel Huntington talked about the clash of civilizations. Now, cultural diversity, as the theme maybe, or let's say the concept that talks to the different issues, is a direct opposite to these statements, that there is a natural tendency in the world for there to be a clash between civilizations. In other words, the concept of cultural diversity takes a completely opposite perspective. And that is also the one that has been very much supported by South Africa, not only in UNESCO, but I think in terms of our general approach to how the world should do its business. The aspect of cultural diversity has also become central to UNESCO's work in the other field. In other words, the aspect, the respect, the promotion, the protection of the diversity of culture in the globe has also become one of the founding principles in the programs on education, in science, and in communication. It has become a cross-cutting, fundamental principle of the way that UNESCO does its work. There was a world report on cultural diversity published in 2009, specifically looking at investing in cultural diversity and also in intercultural dialogue. There has been a number of specific initiatives. For example, the Intercultural Dialogue Initiative came from Spain, it came from Iran. There were different flashpoints around the world where this was picked up and put on the table as an alternative to the approach that was taken unilaterally by the U.S. at that time, and particularly under the presidency of former President Bush. Now, the report that was published in 2009 talks to the fact that cultural diversity is more than just the protection of heritage in danger. It talks to the development of intercultural skills, and as I said, this is applicable right across the board, whether you're talking about cultural areas, education, sciences. This is how our citizens of the world interact with each other. In other words, the development of intercultural skills, and I think some of those aspects are also particularly applicable to South Africa when we consider and challenge the aspects of xenophobia and so forth. How do we foster an approach of recognizing and protecting and promoting and developing intercultural skills? It is considered to be one of the founding principles towards a new form of governance, which rules out domination of groups over each other. It is considered to be a lever to the effectively exercising of universally recognized human rights. And this is where the social sector of UNESCO is particularly applicable. They do a substantive amount of work on human rights. And of course, South Africa being one of the few countries in the world who has economic, social, and cultural rights entrenched in our constitution has also played a very active part there. It is also considered to be a means to reduce the imbalances in the trade of cultural goods and services. And we'll talk to that a little bit more because the convention speaks specifically to this aspect. The 2009 report specifically suggests the establishment of a world observatory on cultural diversity to impact a number of aspects or deal with a number of aspects that that relate to cultural diversity. For example, globalization, setting up public policies and public institutions to deal with cultural diversity, and even talking about specific aspects such as national language policies. Now, the convention itself is the first one in its of its kind in the world. It is the first convention, the first international treaty that deals specifically with the protection of the diversity of cultural expressions. It also talks to cultural goods and services. And the contemporary, what they call the transmitters of cultures, which of course your artists. So it is a convention that deals particularly with the protection of artists, cultural practitioners at the very, very lowest level. The focus is on the protection and promotion, as I said, of the diversity of cultural expressions, specifically linked to globalization. And there are a number of statistics that are put forward about the rapid rate that cultural diversity is becoming extinct. For example, languages, the rapid rate at which languages are simply disappearing. It was initiated in more or less 2001 was the first formal step that was taken when UNESCO adopted a Universal Declaration on Cultural Diversity, and this is a precursor to the convention. A declaration is a non-binding instrument. It does mean that there is political agreement on the concept and the need for protection, but it is not yet an international treaty. Then in 2003, the ICP Ministers of Culture made a submission, a formal submission to the United Nations to propose that an international treaty be negotiated. And at that time, former Minister Benin Gobani was the South African Minister of Culture, and he played a very leading role in the ICP. The ICP is the International Network for Cultural Policies. It's an informal body of ministers who meet once a year and who discuss issues of common concern across all the sectors or all the regions of the world. There are representatives from each one of the regions of the world, and South Africa, together with two or three other African countries, represented the continent. In 2003, the member states of UNESCO then considered the approach and proposal from the Ministers of Culture. At that time, the INCP was a group of 22 ministers, as I said, from all over the world. They then agreed, there was a general agreement that a convention should be developed, and it was initiated immediately. It was felt that there was a great deal of urgency, and there were 2 years of intensive negotiations followed. Honorable members may recall that this was done under the chairmanship of South Africa. Professor Carter Asmal, the former minister, chaired the Intergovernmental Committee in Paris, and it was participated by all the UNESCO members. Finally, in 2005, there were several sessions between 2003 and 2005, and in 2005, a concluded, agreed treaty was put on the table at the 33rd session of the UNESCO General Conference, which was in October 2005. South Africa has since become a member. We have signed and ratified the convention, and we are a state party to it. And the convention came into force in March 2007. The convention itself makes provision for the fact that after 3 months after the 30th state party had ratified the convention, it would then enter into force, which then happened in March 2007. The convention, as I indicated, is considered to be what many people term the Magna Carta of international cultural policy, because while many of the other conventions focus specifically on protection and promotion of the tangible aspects of heritage, for example, monuments, parks, cultural sites, The Convention on Cultural Diversity, as I said, has a very different focus. Has a different, is a focus on grassroots cultural practitioners. Has a focus on policy. Has a very strong underlying focus on development. Has a focus on international cooperation. It is really considered to be the international treaty, which is a product more of the developing world, whereas many of the other cultural conventions were initiatives and products of the developed world. The main objectives, and we've alluded to some of these before, is the recognition and that cultural goods and services, in other words, this would include your crafters, your musicians, artists, all aspects, all the cultural genres and services, that they also convey identity, that they are not only tangible goods that are subject to trade, but that they convey identity, individual identity, national identity, that they have value and meaning, and therefore that they cannot be considered as one would consider other consumer products. This is one of the focuses of the convention that comes out very strongly. A second one relates to an encouragement of governments to introduce cultural policies or adopt cultural policies that address all the links in the value chain. In other words, the policies that government puts on the table that looks at the protection and promotion of the aspects of culture that deals with creation, deals with production, deals with distribution, and also the access and the enjoyment, the entire chain of value in cultural goods and services. And then, as I mentioned, a very strong focus on international cooperation. Some of the activities that that state parties are called upon in terms of the convention to carry out is the development of a complete set of operational guidelines. Now, this is basically an interpretive tool. In other words, if you say that state parties are called upon to develop a certain policy, your operational guidelines unpack for you best practices and examples of how this can be done. The second part is that there is a call on for the ratification of the convention, that all countries of the globe should buy in and should ratify and become state parties to the treaty. There is a specific focus on the creation of an international fund for cultural diversity, and we'll come back to that to a moment. And then what is also very important, and which is also unique and new to this particular convention, this particular treaty, is that mechanisms are provided for preferential treatment for artists and cultural practitioners from developing countries. And this is a first in the world. As I mentioned, South Africa has participated from the very beginning, from the conceptual phase where the ministers within the International Network of Cultural policies conceptualized the idea, taking it to UNESCO, convincing the member states that we need a binding international treaty, through to the negotiations which we chaired, and then South Africa, post the adoption of the convention, was also elected to serve on the Intergovernmental Committee of the convention. The Intergovernmental Committee is really the watchdog to ensure that the convention is being implemented. One of the main tasks is to look at the development of the operational guidelines, and that process is ongoing at the moment. And then, as I indicated, the purpose of the guidelines is to provide best practices in terms of how this could be done. I mentioned there is a specific guidelines which has already been adopted for a number of the articles of the convention, and then the work that is currently underway. There will be another session of the Intergovernmental Committee will take place in Paris in December, and they will be looking at the development of operational guidelines for specific articles. To come back to the fund that was created, the convention recognizes that specifically for the developing world, certain support, whether it's financial or technical, is necessary and fundamental to enable the developing countries, countries of the developing world, and also the least developed countries to implement the provisions of the convention. So for that purposes, a specific fund was created in the convention itself, mention is made of the creation of this fund. As I say, the purpose of the fund is to promote cooperation for sustainable development, poverty reduction, and these are all directly linked to, as we mentioned, the value chain of arts and culture practitioners. And then, of course, to develop and to encourage and cooperative approaches between the developing countries and the developed countries. The fund is not a compulsory fund, and this is one of its weaknesses, that it is a voluntary fund at this stage. Unfortunately, in the process of negotiations, the developed world could not be convinced that it should be a compulsory contribution. Therefore, the fund calls for voluntary contributions. South Africa has already made a voluntary contribution of, as it says there, 87,000 rand to the fund, which is the equivalent of 1% of our annual contribution to UNESCO. These guidelines were written into the convention. The fund has already initiated a first call for applications to be put forward for financial and technical assistance. South Africa had submitted 13 proposals earlier this year. Six of those proposals have passed the first evaluation and criteria test, and they will be put to the Intergovernmental Committee in December for consideration. Now, those particular projects that were submitted relate to come from a cross section of the country. There were projects from Limpopo, Eastern Cape, other provinces. Some of them relate to music. There is a music project. There is a project for an art support center and an artist village development in Limpopo. There is a project proposal for a research project to research the tax initiatives, tax incentives that are made available to corporations in terms of supporting arts and culture. There's an indigenous language publishing project was one that was put forward. There's the rehabilitation of an art center proposal from the Eastern Cape. So these are a number of the proposals that South Africa had put forward for funding consideration and which will be considered in December. Briefly, in conclusion, the number of countries that have ratified the convention, together with South Africa, at the moment stands at 113. There will be a new campaign is being launched for the promotion of the convention, and also a strategy is being devised to create visibility, specifically in underrepresented regions. At the moment, the European countries Europe has the highest number of countries that have ratified the convention, and then followed by the other regions. Africa is more or less in the middle. The Department of Arts and Culture will also be participating in this awareness-raising campaign. We plan to have a number of consultative workshops in the different provinces, also with civil society and with arts and cultural practitioners, to promote the implementation and also the application of the convention. And then the 21st of May annually has been declared a specific day of focus on cultural diversity. If I can maybe just mention, I mentioned one or two of the weaknesses that is inherent in the convention. But there are also a number of key fundamental underlying principles that drive the convention. And the one thereof is respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. And many of these underlying principles are also encapsulated in the South African Constitution, which means that they are not difficult for us to comply with. The sovereignty of nation states to adopt cultural policies, and this is entrenched in the convention, that cultural policies that they may adopt cultural policies for the protection of culture and heritage in their own regions, equal dignity and respect for all cultures, a very strong emphasis on international solidarity, and then, of course, as I mentioned, the underlying fundamental principles of sustainable development. Chairperson, with your permission and agreement, and I apologize if the presentation has been a little long, I will stop there, and of course I think the Director General may wish to add some comments, but from our side, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I'm covered. Thanks a lot, Chairperson. I'll participate in the discussion. Thank you.
Okay. We will then move back to the discussion for members to follow the presentation of the chapter, and now we have an opportunity to interact with the presentation. May I maybe start five members of thinking? Oh, much better.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and wonderful presentation from the department. I'm still having that big problem as far as the retrieving of the valuable heritage artifacts, which I believe that maybe artists are aware or not aware, I don't know. That's my first question. When we grow, I mean, especially as vendors, we used to conquer our enemies during this fight. I don't know how far true it is now, at present. We heard that they were using a special drum, which is called Ngomarungundu. We haven't seen it yet. They used to beat that drum, and then all the enemies would just fall asleep, and then they conquer. That's what we're told. It belongs to the Chivasa royalties. And we were told that it is taken by the then apartheid regime, and is kept at the museum. So we wanted to take our thing back, at least for to belong to where it belongs. So we are denied. I don't know whether you are aware of it. Another thing is that, like you the presenter indicated here, that. UNICEF and UNESCO, let me be specific, UNICEF is not there to build whatever, but I still remember, again, if I'm not mistaken, while still chairing social development, UNICEF was sort of helping the orphans. So I'm wondering, when you said that it's not there to fund or to build clinics and schools, because this orphans are sometimes, there are certain people who really feel like taking care of them. And where are they going to get the funds? Because we thought maybe UNICEF is there to take care of the orphans and those children who are just, you know, who are scattered all over. They just pick them, and then who will fund them if UNICEF is not really responsible for such conditions and such children? Thank you. Those are my first two questions.
Any further questions or comments on the matter?
Thank you very much for the presentation, Chairperson, by the department. I just want to know, I'm interested in this because I can see South Africa has participated a long way, you know, to come to the decision of a convention. I wanted to know if we do have a booklet or a document on the convention so that we can be provided with.
That's a good question. Our members are familiarized with the convention. Any further? I think I would like to
hear another question.
until the retrieval of valuable documents, I'm told, I heard, I don't have any tangible really proof, that there were documents which were in Rivonia, and the very same documents, special documents, were being taken away, were stolen, I heard, by those who are able to conceal. And they're not yet retrieved back to South Africa. I don't know whether you're aware of that. So, regardless of those ones, there are those people who sometimes value some artifacts for whoever can make a wonderful thing, a beautiful thing, and then sort of like stealing. They just grab it. How are you retrieving those things which are taken by the foreigners over these people?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think this is not a question. I just want to talk about this UNESCO. This is the first time maybe I heard about UNESCO. I'm trying to follow up, to follow the presentation from the department. When I was listening, I just heard that the UNESCO is cross-cutting to so many departments like education, water, arts and culture, science and technology. Now I was trying to make sure that maybe I follow up everything that they were presenting today, and. There's one question maybe I want to ask about how many members who are serving in this committee of our national committee, how many members are serving as a region, South African region, because I heard that their office is at Windhoek. And how many members from South Africa are serving there? Because this is the first time maybe since I was in this committee, heard about the illness.
My last question.
You happen to mention the underwater properties, which one had a problem. Of so let's say, I'm just setting an example. Jan van der Beek really just passed here. Or we go somewhere and then have a valuable, how can I put it, a valuable whatever thing which is really valuable to our country. How can you really give or who qualifies to have that thing because it was found in the water? Who qualifies to take it because you find that two countries are claiming the very same article, that it is theirs, South Africa says it's theirs, maybe Russia or America or Holland says it's theirs. How do you really solve that problem of claiming because it was found underwater and the people are just passing by here, the then people? Because I remember when we visited Holland one year, we found a boat broken there and it is written Jan van der Beek. I said, who is this Jan van der Beek? Just wanting to know, maybe they know him. They said, it's an unknown person. He said, no, he damaged our history down there. Our history started from him. How can you say you don't know him? He said, no, we don't know him. I said, don't you have something for remembrance at least as a heritage? They say he's unknown, but here he has done a big damage. So what about the artifacts which you find right in the water and then maybe the other country claim it that is there? How can you say this one qualify, and what is the proof? Thank you.
I think let's have a response to this question, and then we'll have another one.
All right. Thank you, Chairperson. And
this is whatever you're going to say.
Thank you, Chairperson. Much of us saying I have been having this conversation for years. So it's a continuing conversation. The first question is on retrieving or restitution and repatriation of cultural heritage. And it's a highly political one. And I remember one time the former Minister of Culture, Dr. Paulo Jordan, was having a conversation with his counterpart, Minister of Culture from Britain, and they were debating this question. And the minister from the UK said, but why is it that the developing world keeps clamoring about these things? Now, the British Museum has got everybody's artifacts from all over the world, and they don't want to let go of them. And the answer from Dr. Jordan was that we will stop clamoring when you stop holding on to what is not yours. It nearly turned ugly, that conversation. But it's a very, very a pressing issue. And it hasn't been resolved, but there are some cases where, for example, Italy returned back to Ethiopia the what was that one? The obelisk of Aksum. And then we have a situation where South African government negotiated with the Dutch on the anti-apartheid records of the Dutch anti-apartheid movement. Excuse me, and those were returned. And it is the stuff that was taken during colonialism that is very difficult to get back, you know. And of course, it has got also I think some psychological things. You know, if you are a Nigerian child growing up in Lagos, and you have never seen the best of the Nigerian art because your artifacts, your heritage was taken by the British, all right? And then the British are able to mount the best exhibition on Nigerian heritage, you know? What does that mean? If you are a Nigerian child, you say, I've never contributed to the world. And if you are a British child, you say, I've been all over the world. And here's the proof that you have been all over the world, you know. It's very, very difficult, this matter. And it also extends itself to the areas of conflict. You know, that when people fight, the first thing that they destroy is the culture of the enemy. First thing. And there is a reason for that. It's a psychological reason, you know, because your culture is what anchors you, is what gives you stamina to fight back. And if you take that away, it gives you an advantage against your enemy. But having said all of that, it's not only a question of repatriation on international level. There is repatriation on national level. For example, the fact that the Mapungubwe artifacts were at the University of Pretoria, and they were just recently revealed and some artifacts returned, it's just a proof that there's a lot that is also within the country that we know that is still in private hands or in public public institutions. The question of the Rivonia trial document is that there are a number of that of records. There were the ones that were taken by Percy Yuta, who was the prosecutor of during that the Rivonia trial. That Percy Yuta sold to the Oppenheimers, to the Brandeis Library. And there is also another collection that the son of Yuta still has, which he refuses to release because he says that that was his father's private papers. All right. Now, the question is, how can you make private papers out of a public case like that, the judicial case? We negotiated, of course, with the Oppenheimer family, and I must say that they were very gracious in those negotiations, and then they returned the Rivonia documents to the state, and those documents are with the archives. Now, with regards to, we will send the convention documents and some other background conceptual document around the convention, and we'll also submit the convention. Now, Matiba also asked the question: how then do you protect? We protect through the South African Heritage Resources Act of 1999. Which says that there are certain items of national value and which you cannot export from the country. If you are going to export from the country, you will then need to get a permission from South African Heritage Resources Agency. And there are also international conventions on the illicit trafficking of cultural goods and trying to protect the trafficking of artifacts. On a personal note, I nearly did not become a bureaucrat, and I nearly got fired in my first year as a chief director. Because there was a ship that sank next to Port Elizabeth, between Port Elizabeth on the coast there. And that ship was called Doddington. And then there were people who came in, divers, who searched for these treasures. And then they got the coins. And then those coins were supposed to have gone to the Port Elizabeth Museum. And then they went, they moved from South Africa to Miami, Florida. From Miami, Florida, they showed up at an auction house in London. Now, that day they're going on the auction house, on auction, we get a letter from our High Commissioner in London. There's this matter that is going on auction. We need to know what to do. And I said, interdict, you know. Let's go for a court interdict. And I did not know that I had no right. It was only the DG who had the right to authorize for a court interdict. So, and the DG was not around, you know. So I did not consult Rob Adams. We just went ahead and did that. What saved me was that, one, I pleaded that the case was an emergency. Two, we won the case. Three, we brought back the Doddington coins. So I did not incur fruitless expenditure for the state. That's the only thing that saved me. So, yes, and these are the other ways of protecting Mashivas, you know. And but it's expensive. There are many times where another way of protecting is to watch what is going on these auctions. And the times when things are legitimate, the sales are legitimate, then you quietly buy. You know, we have bought at the state on Gerard Court quietly, mm-hmm. using private galleries, and say go and bid, mm-hmm. and they bid for us, and then we get things back. But it is very, very difficult. There is currently a conversation that is happening within the NGO, that big NGO in Sawa Street. And the NGO that's going to be celebrating the centenary in 2012. And one of the things that you are looking at is what do we do, for example, with the records that were not stolen, but they legitimately reflect on South African history. For example, the United Nations UN Special Committee Against Apartheid. That agency was just set up purely to deal with the issue of South Africa and Namibia. You know, and is it possible for us to even get back those copies of those documents and to South Africa so that when the centenary happens, we can be able to reflect on some of those things. And there is also an act on underwater, protecting underwater cultural heritage. And then that is linked to the issue, of course, of national waters. If the artifacts are within the national waters, then the artifacts belong to that particular country. But if they are, well, there's a contestation whether they are on the international waters, then there is a problem. But it's quite a fascinating one, and because at times the territorial waters are a cause for war, you know, as it was the case with Argentina and Britain, and over Falkland Islands. So you get those contestations all the time. Now I've answered the easy ones, and my colleagues will assist with the difficult ones.
Thank you, DG. No, the ones that have remained are quite simple. I must, Chairperson and honourable members, I must apologise if I was not clear on the UNICEF comparison. I simply wanted to say that quite the opposite, obviously, to the impression that I gave. Whereas UNICEF is a downstream implementing agent, they do build schools and clinics. UNESCO does not. UNESCO doesn't build anything. It is more a think tank. It does provide seed money, and it facilitates international cooperation, and it has a number of small funds, but it does not have nearly the budget of the big UN implementing agencies. So my apologies if I created a misinterpretation there. With regard, as the DG said, with regard to the documents on the convention, yes, we certainly can make that available. We have a concept document. We have a number of documents. We can put together a package and make that available. On the question of the South African National Commission and the Windhoek office, the Windhoek office is really a UNESCO office, so we do not have any South African serving at the Windhoek office. The staff that serve in Windhoek are all sent by UNESCO from Paris. They would have it's a very small office. They only have five or six transferred staff members and then some local staff members. So they would have an office manager and then somebody responsible for culture, somebody responsible for education, and they don't even have all the competencies of UNESCO necessarily in one office. The South African National Commission itself at the moment is, the numbers differ from time to time or vary, but all the departments who have an interest in UNESCO, who work in any of the areas that UNESCO has a competency for, they have ex officio members on the National Commission at a fairly senior level, at the level of a chief director or above, and then they obviously bring in staff members at the operational level as well. Currently, the National Commission is being chaired by Professor Brian Segaji, who had also been the South African Executive Board member for 4 years at UNESCO. He was our formal representative to the Executive Board, and he currently chairs the NATCOM. And then, the drums. I think the DG have spoken about the complexities and the difficulties of restitution. In the international arena, we are bound by the international treaties that we have signed, the 54 Convention, Hague Convention, the 1970 Convention. These are administered by UNESCO, and they deal specifically, as was said, with illicit trafficking and with restitution and of cultural goods. But we also have continental instruments, the Charter on African Cultural Renaissance and the Cultural Convention of the OAU and the AU respectively. And then nationally, I think we have a number of actions projects apart from the Act. We also have a number of internal processes. But as I think the DG has expanded on that significantly, there are many, many challenges there. There are ownership which is challenged. There are the retrieval. There is finding the goods in many instances. And then, of course, there are with drums and tangible goods, there are certain processes and issues of ownership. But there are also areas that are much more complicated where we deal with human remains. And the department has been involved in a number of these projects at the same time across the spectrum to retrieve them. The South African position in general is that we are, and this is a position that we take internationally, but I think many of the aspects are also applicable nationally, is that we are in favor of the restitution of cultural goods. That has been our fundamental departing point all along. Thank you, Chair.
I think one question is how members in the UNESCO, they are pretty old and so popularize this convention. But I think it would be helpful if we get all that information, and we would really like to be part of this roadshow that you spoke about. But I think it would help us to be very clear on exactly what it is, how we can, define our own role.
Chairperson, I'm trying to familiarize myself with all these discussions. But definitely now it comes to light to me why we had in our State of the Nation speeches from our former president alluding to some of our heritage, especially the Mapungu, because he always had that. I'm just thinking how these two would relate in the global effect of economy. You find our artifacts scattered around the world, in places like London. On the other hand, the DTI is encouraging that we play a significant role in global economy. And how would these two relate to each other? You discover that you find artifacts in London that are in their museums. What implication does it have on exposure of South Africa? Yeah, I don't know how, maybe when the departments sit together, these different roles that they have to play. I'm just putting this jigsaw together.
I said that was the last question. My concern is, another concern is that, I think it's year before last, when we visited France, I wanted to know where Sarah Bartman was really placed. You can imagine, a tour guide said that she doesn't really know who is this person. So meaning that the history is now hidden, and the cruelty which was happening there. Francis, I'm just saying things which are not written, but what I heard, because I really questioned that lady that, can you show us where Sarah? She said, who is this Sarah Bartman? I said, you know her. She said, no. I said, you are lying, because she denied that she doesn't know her. I said, she was here, and she was sort of like, you know, displayed. I mean, there is nobody who doesn't know who this Sarah Bartman is. So if such history is really distorted from where this ill treatment were happening, what is art and culture going to do or is doing if such history is really sort of like, you know, brushed? So how do you really relate with those people who behave like that?
About this artifacts in London and our, maybe have you answered it? I think it's our best to answer.
Let me perhaps start with the last one.
I think
one.
You have touched on it.
Let me start with the last one, and then my colleague will deal with the question of culture and traded goods. The question Machiba is asking is very complex. Is that how does the colonized, or how do people who are colonized deal with the colonizer? You know, that's the first one. The second one is the question of what should constitute memory of that relationship. And these are all fundamentally difficult political questions. But it's hard, particularly for the later generation to deal with some of these things. And you know, at one stage, even when we were asking for the repatriation of the remains of Sarah Bartman, it took ages, you know, because they said that was not a human being. What we saw there was a scientific specimen.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Now, that was the conversation that is happening post 94. And then we then set up a team to advise the department to deal with how we were going to approach the French. And we said, no, we're not going to argue from scientific basis. We are going to argue on human rights basis. Yeah. And when we started arguing from human rights point of view, then the French said, okay, you are making sense. However, all artifacts that are in our museum cannot be repatriated because the French law does not allow for it to happen. So how do we affect or influence French Parliament? And it took a conversation between a former president, was it Mitterrand? And Madiba.
Mitterrand.
Yeah. And then there was a senator that sponsored an act on Sarah Batman only. They said, that is the only thing we're going to do, and South Africa must take a, must commit that after we've granted this repatriation, there will be no further claim on the French government. So it's an unfinished conversation. I don't know what the answer is, but when you know you get all of these things when we deal with the question of repatriation, but as my colleague indicated, the position of government is that people should be given their heritage and be able to look after their heritage. And one of the things that, I mean, for example, countries like Britain and France have been using, they would say that African countries are poor. They cannot look after this heritage. So as a matter of fact, you are doing you guys a favor by keeping your heritage. You know? And what level of arrogance can one, anyway? That's just how it is. It's just politically, I mean, it's a fundamentally political question. And and I think we just need to carry on in all the other platforms, internationally and nationally, until we manage to make sense. It took us 6 years to negotiate with the French on Sarah Batman, but ultimately we got that. Louise, can you please take the one on Congress? Yeah.
Thank you, TG. Maybe just on Sarah Batman as well, because I was in Paris at the South African Embassy when we were in the process of bringing back Sarah Batman. And just in terms of the question that you asked, how can they not know who it is or where she was? What was really horrifying is when we visited the remains of Sarah Batman, these were not in a public area. These were, at that time, she had previously been on display, but at that time it had been put into the vaults and the basements of the museum. And there were 3,000 plus other human remains. So some of them known, some of them unknown, but I think for us, it was an individual, it was a person who was known, but many of the other remains were not known, especially to the French. They have them there. It is the most horrifying experience to go in there, into this place where all these human remains are. But I think the average French person just simply does not know, including maybe the tour guide, just simply does not know. They're simply just not aware of the enormity of what the situation is. With regard to the question on the and this is a very fundamental one, the question of the potential contradiction between the trade in cultural goods and the protection of artists and cultural practitioners. And this is something which plays out quite significantly in the international arena. Because while UNESCO is busy making, creating international protection mechanisms for cultural goods and cultural services and objects, of course the World Trade Organization is at the same time writing rules for free trade, which includes cultural goods and services. So the negotiations around the cultural diversity, there were invitations extended to the WTO, to the World Trade Organization. They participated in the deliberations, but there are still many areas where there are differences of opinion on how this should be dealt with. The South African nationally as well, the South African department, that when we negotiated the Cultural Diversity Convention, we had discussions with the Department of Trade and Industry as well. But it's not an easy or a comfortable marriage, if I could use the term, because we have two completely different perspectives on the matter. Another aspect which comes to play both nationally and internationally is the aspect, of course, of intellectual property rights. And in our deliberations, the World Intellectual Property Rights Organization was also involved. And certain exceptions were made for cultural goods and services in terms of the normal trade in the international arena. So there is some provision made for protection of cultural goods and services, but it is not a it is not completely excluded from free trade agreements. And it's an ongoing discussion with the departments, both nationally and internationally. Mm-hmm. I think those were,
yeah,
Chair, the key questions. Thank you.
May I just say something? You know, this is not really becoming this. What? Do we have a structure that is actually working on trying to, you know, you've got this copyright and I think now of the one had a very beautiful female book, and I bought a CD of the Dark Sisters in London, and at the back of the cover it's written, it's owned by what's his character, the one who owns Vision actually,
Richard Branson.
He's got a division, I think, because it's just that is a property of that division. I think it's called Earth or something. So they own that music of the Baxter system. So the music of the Baxter system is owned by Richard Branson. And that means, in my mind, that there are no royalties for those who actually the creators. And I think there are many such examples. So what is it that we do we have a structure that really looks at the things and, you know, with the department trying to address this situation?
Yes, thank you, Chairperson.
You will recall that that was explained with the lady who was in the city situation, who had bought a number of paintings in the 80s and the 70s and gave it back to us. And I think there were some people who voluntarily, you know, gave back the stuff. So for them it was like, you know, they were protecting that which could have been lost during that part of the day.
Yes, there is a initiative on addressing that. The Swedes, together with the Australians, were the first ones to start to return back the material voluntarily. And the campaign in Australia is being led by the former, I've got to remember his surname now, former Prime Minister of Australia. And well, there is an organization that we fund. It's called Ifaletu, which is based in Pretoria, and is being the CEO is Narisa Ramdani, and they are the ones who are looking and cataloging and the artwork. And so it would be actually quite interesting if they can come in and just brief the portfolio committee about the work that they do, because it really deserves to get national attention. And then there is SAMRO, South African Music Rights Organization, which has got a catalogue of the people and their rights. Some of the problem we have
is that there are some of these artists sold their rights not knowing that they were selling their rights, you know. And let me tell you something that you might find worrying. We had to assist the Makeba family so that the family can claim the rights, even of using the name Miriam Makeba. All right? Because people have, at times, they don't understand what is there. There is a case, that one with the Makeba family, we are quite confident we have managed to make a proper impact. Then there is a question of the music rights that were literally stolen, as was with the case of Simon Linda Imbube, you know. We also assisted the family there with Disney. As a matter of fact, Disney did not want to pay anything until the lawyers said that they are going to went to seek for a court interdict, and so that that they would then be in charge of all Disney stores and Disney products in South Africa, and they cannot trade until that matter was resumed, and that's how we got into a settlement with Disney. But it's not. It's what Abdullah Ibrahim used to say. He used to say to me, you know, Temba, out there, it's dog. Yeah. And so if you don't have that situation or protection, at one stage, what we had thought was that it's just that the musicians are also, I'm sorry to say this, but it was then, they're disorganized. Yeah. You know. And because at one stage we said to them, get your union together. Once you have got your union together, we can talk about law clinics, we can talk about all these things that can be of service to the musicians, you know? No. And it's a struggle. And perhaps the artistic egos are such that they cannot ever be organized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The overrepresented, if one could argue, now these are global regions that we're talking about. So the overrepresented region is Europe. The underrepresented regions would include Africa, Asia, Latin America. Thank you.
We would like to pursue that, but at the present moment there's a lot of trouble in Conakry.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of problems. Maybe once But yes, in principle, we should do that.
I think this brings us to the end of this meeting. Let me thank the committee and the same members for their participation in this webinar. Oh, I'm sorry about the minutes that we have to do. But that's
outside of my
outside this meeting that we will consider now. So let me take the members or the names that we think close to the minute. We won't be long, so we still have to see some.
Yes. Okay, can I come back to your office in half an hour, please? Okay? What would you do?
I don't think we're going to be done yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Then I'll get to it. It's time.
Do we have copies of this minister? On page 1, there also like. Pardon? I wouldn't have. I don't think there should be a problem. They are not here. Let me put it this way. This CRL is actually a completely different issue because these people are never coming. So I don't know. We can postpone this to our next meeting. Is fine. I don't think there will be a problem. Maybe we should do that. If members think that they want to do that. Okay, let me allow the secretary to
respond. Although I think because we've all been invited, unless we say that some other problem, but that it doesn't have, if this meeting qualifies, it's not necessarily. So finding that members of the opposition have to be in the meeting for us.
I think to read what you have been
asking. If we have the numbers.
Like you're saying now, where they have submitted their so they are bound by our
I'm going to run by and see. after time to adopt the unit.
Okay, then this meeting is adjourned. Hey, like it or not, there's no problem for us to do it, but I think you are not. Yeah, I've already joined it, so we'll... Can we have a move up for adoption? Manu Malomo. Seconder? Yeah, room for second. The meeting, the minutes are adopted. And thank you.